if you're not leveraging technology to a great degree, that bank is not going to exist in 10 years from now. It's one of the things that could hold a lot of banks back. It's an indicator that this is not a bank that's ready for what we're bringing, right? But they're also not ready for a lot of other stuff too. And that's going to affect them over the long term. So I think that's underestimated, the culture of the bank being such to where you can evaluate things and make a decision and move forward and do so in a timely manner. Because if it takes you 18 months to make a decision, compound that times all the decisions you have to make, and you're going to be a decade behind everybody else.
Welcome to the Operate Podcast, where we give you a behind-the-scenes look at company building from the perspective of the builders themselves. This is how we operate.
Welcome to the Operate Podcast. I'm Kerry Ransom. Today's episode is sponsored by BankTech Ventures, the first strategic investment fund designed by the community banking industry for community bank innovation and investment. BankTech identifies leading products and technologies for community banks, works with the founders and management teams to maximize the impact for the community banks and their businesses. If you are a bank looking to innovate and invest in your future, or a founder who wants to work with community banks, reach out to BankTech Ventures at banktechventures.com. My guest today is Brian Bauer, the CEO of Revio. They are a really exciting banking and analytics technology startup that is helping banks understand and act upon what I would call their core banking transaction data in ways that can really help grow the bank. And we're going to talk a lot more about that today. Brian spent the last several years in the fintech and banking world, both inside a fintech accelerator, and one that I would consider probably the best one in the world, and also co-founder and president of a banking startup that focused on the cannabis sector. And they successfully exited that company. He also has over a 10-year military career where he served with some of our country's most elite soldiers and developed his leadership skills, sense of team, and a culture of excellence. I've really enjoyed getting to know Brian over the last couple of years and do appreciate those leadership capabilities, his entrepreneurial spirit, his tenacity, and also I would say his commitment and interest in the community banking world and his desire to help it. Brian, thank you so much for joining. Excited to have this conversation.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I appreciate the kind words on the introduction. And, you know, certainly have been a listener of the podcast and glad to be here.
Well, let's get going. It has been a wild year in banking, and I would also say in the banking technology world. How do you think about this year as you describe it to others?
Yeah, look, it has been a crazy year, and it's been a learning year, I think, for a lot of folks, myself included. But that's no different than it's been so far in the 2020s, right? The start of this decade, what started with volatility and uncertainty. And, you know, that seems to have been a trend that has continued year after year. So, you know, what a resilient industry we have to be able to, first of all, navigate those things. Because I feel like we've been thrown, you know, 50 years worth of curveballs in just 3 years. Sure. So, you know, it has been a wild year. There's been a lot to learn, I think, this year in terms of just navigating change. You know, and I think banks have been impacted certainly by the rapid adjustment in rates, which has kind of led to a lot of repricing of deposits. You know, I think to my last venture, and, you know, we were a fintech company that was effectively helping banks get deposits, right? Mm-hmm. And I can remember having conversations with banks just a couple of years ago, wherein we're talking about the benefits that we were bringing in terms of deposits. And they were not as interested then in those deposits, right? They were really more interested in, well, you know, how can you bring me fee income? How can you bring me loans and those types of things? Because really, we've got more deposits than we need. And, you know, here we are just a few short years later, and that paradigm has totally upended itself. And, you know, I talk to a lot of bankers every day, and their loan officers are now doubling as deposit officers. Mm. And in some cases, or in most cases, for the first time in their careers, those individuals who have been concentrating on going out and finding loans are now really concerned with, you know, they know they can't do a loan if they can't get deposits along with it. And so, you know, that's really changed things, I think, in the industry. And it's also led to a lot of uncertainty, right? You know, despite the volatility, banks have had a decent couple of years here. And, but that now there's a degree of budgetary uncertainty as we are going through this exercise as an industry to reprice deposits due to the interest rate adjustments that have gone on. And, you know, that's just led to some budgetary uncertainty as well. So I think that reverberates out into the technology provider space and the technology partner space, because we're obviously interfacing with these banks and trying to have conversations about what creates value for them. And so, you know, that uncertainty on the bank side has led to uncertainty, I think, across the industry. But I think we're coming through that, right? I can kind of sense now that we're getting through that repricing exercise that our bank clients are going through. And, you know, they're looking at 2024 and with some positive indications on the economy, I kind of feel like late in the quarter here, we're feeling a little bit better about how 2024 might turn out.
Okay. Well, great analysis. And I think a ton to really dig into there. You feel like, you know, these last 3 years, as you said, you know, I think for many, it feels like it's been this compressed decade or multi-decade of activity in a few short years. And that may be the reality we face for the foreseeable future. And so to me, that says I need to have as many levers available to me if I'm a bank for both access to liquidity as I need it, access to assets as I need them. How do you think about the understanding? I mean, the bank of 2 or 3 years from now feels to me like one that needs to have so much more access and optionality available to it. How do you think about that with the banks that you're talking to?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, we don't know that the rate of change is going to slow down, right? There's no necessarily indication. I think maybe to your point, that's going to be the case. And so when we talk to folks that have been in the industry a long time and they've looked at things like data, it's not always been the case that banks have been interested in things like insights. But, you know, if you go back 20 years or so, and I've certainly not been in the industry that long, but have, you know, had the benefit of knowing a lot of people who have and have had a lot of great conversations. You know, I think there's been ebbs and flows in the industry and people have not always been as interested in the information that they can derive from their own core systems and from their own transaction records or really any other analytics, right? Mm-hmm. I think as things have gotten more volatile, that's definitely been a pressure on bankers to, you know, how do I gain a competitive advantage? And I think that banks are getting a lot more practical when it comes to innovation right now. You know, they're looking at the changes in the industry and they've been focused for many years on solving macro level trends. If you look at conferences that we've all attended over the last several years and all the talk of blockchain and the disruption mm-hmm. and, you know, all these things that are really 3, 4, 5, 10 year macro trends that in many cases, a lot of these things have been threats that have really never materialized. Right. But there's been a lot of energy, a lot of capital, a lot of partnerships that have formed with financial institutions and with technology providers that are meant to address these macro trends. And again, many of them have really not delivered on the threat that was promised maybe in the sure. beginning. I think what's happening right now is banks are kind of being forced to refocus on the present. Mm-hmm. Right. And how do we solve today's problems? Because, you know, between those macro level trends, maybe not playing out as advertised, and the reality of where we are today, I think everyone's gotten a lot more practical. And so what I'm seeing is a lot of banks getting a lot more practical with innovation, a lot more practical about how do these things help me grow or retain customers or be competitive this quarter, this year versus some large project that helps me, you know, 12 months or 18 months or 24 months down the line, even though I think that there's definitely things that you have to do that are heavy lifts that take place on those types of timelines. I think there's still, you know, things that you have to do in the industry that probably take time to figure out and navigate through. But I think it's a lot more practical in terms of how do you help me compete today? And we don't need to get it launched right now because we need to be competing today and next quarter and the quarter after that. And so, you know, how does this look over the long term? I think that trend of practicality continues, right? Because the more uncertainty there is, the more there is a need for certainty around the things that I can do and can control that, you know, are within kind of my realm of influence, whether it's an executive at the bank or the bank itself in the market, right?
Yeah. Totally makes sense. And I do find that most bank executives are more pragmatists. They understand banking. And let's use that as really a jumping off point, because I feel like Revio and what you're doing there is addressing this at such a central level. So as you think about Revio in the present, in the pragmatic, how do we get better? Why don't you start with, you know, giving the audience a little bit of intro to how you're addressing that for banks, because I do think it is so timely, but also so useful to that reality.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I think there's a gap in analytics and insights in the industry, right? And I think there's good solutions out there, right? There's a lot of ways that you can kind of slice and dice and get value from data and analysis on that data and the information you can derive from it. And there's a few layers of that I've seen. And the way we kind of define it is, you know, there's that peer benchmarking that you can do that, you know, show how does my bank stacking up in performance against other banks that are in my peer groups, and trying to understand that better to help me ideate around how my institution can perform better relative to those peers. There's kind of general ledger data where you're looking at it like within the bank, you know, what has my performance been, you know, week to week, month to month, quarter to quarter. But a lot of that analysis that exists out there is akin to kind of looking in the rearview mirror. Right? Mm-hmm. Those reports and dashboards and those types of things are fantastic for certain types of strategic decisions to be made, because you can't make those decisions without information. There's solutions that are out there on the market that are addressing in those realms right now and helping banks in that way. I think where Revio fits in and the gap that exists in the market is after you've done some of that analysis, it kind of begs the question of what next? What do I do about it, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever the trend line might be, right? What do I do next in order to improve performance? And I think that's kind of where we come in, is it's more of less the rearview mirror and maybe more the GPS that's telling us now where we need to go to get to the destination. You know, you've got customers at your institution and you're not capturing all of that customer relationship, right? You're not capturing the entirety of the value of that customer relationship. You could be serving those customers better. They have deposit accounts with you, or they may have a loan with you, or whatever the case may be, but they don't have most or the majority of their services with you, right? And so that is really low-hanging fruit, whether it comes to a deposit opportunity for a bank, or it comes to a lending opportunity or merchant services, or, you know, either commercial or personal credit cards, you know, the variety of financial products that most of the community banks in this country are offering to their customers today. They've got, in most cases, I think, an answer for those products that those customers need. But those customers need to be reached out to. You need to develop that relationship. And I think what we're doing at Revio is helping banks understand on a per customer level, and not just giving them analysis, not just giving them a trend of what that customer has been doing, but where is my actual opportunity to expand that relationship with a customer, to deepen that relationship? Because customer acquisition cost is going up. You know, we talk to a lot of banks and they're competing against the largest institutions in the country that have virtually unlimited funding. And you've got a whole bunch of fintech challengers that are out there that have been funded by kind of Silicon Valley over the last several years that are all out there trying to eat away at the market. And that's a lot that's going on out there that's outside the community bank's control. And so that's been driving up that customer acquisition cost. So you're having to participate in that same market as a community bank and pay those higher fees for acquiring that customer. Where we come in is, all right, well, now that you've got them, let's deepen that relationship and increase lifetime value, increase profitability, because that's really the ticket to long-term sustainable growth. It's not to say that net new customer acquisition is, you still got to do that, right? You still got to go out there and compete in the market for net new customers, but where are my opportunities to deepen those relationships, expand the relationship, because that is the ticket to grow long-term growth sustainably and profitable customer relationships. And it helps us serve those customers better, right? It's good for the bank in terms of, you know, can you capture more products and services with these customers, but it's also good for the customer too, right? I mean, in almost every case, these community banks are investing back into the communities that they're serving, and they're able to provide a more personalized service to that customer versus, you know, calling into some, you know, far off call center where you're just a number on a screen. Having that relationship with an individual banker that you can pick up the phone, talk to, and they know who you are and solve your problems, I think that's better for the customer too. And so, you know, that's kind of where we think we fit into the market.
Well, thank you for that intro, Brian. Let's go a little bit deeper on a few things. Let's start first. Yeah, often you'll hear banks say, well, Kerry, we know our customers. We know these. How are you illuminating them in ways that they think they know, but maybe don't really know? And, you know, I think you and I probably share a similar view that data is generally pretty objective in that it's going to show the reality of the situation. How are you helping them really understand what they think they know is only a partial picture?
Yeah, I think you're right. And in a lot of cases, they do know a lot of their customers, right? And especially their good customers. You know, if you're one of those customers that is kind of the bank's top 20% clients, I think, you know, because those are the ones that are kind of showing up at the top of all the reports, right? So you can see the business that you're doing with them. You know, occasionally we'll do these proof of values with our customers that are, you know, coming into the pipeline. They want to see, okay, well, what can you surface? What can you uncover? And it's happened on more than one occasion where we've shown these insights to the senior executive team at a bank, and they see customers that they know on that list, wherein they thought that they really had that full customer relationship captured. So there's been some surprising results wherein they thought that they had, you know, maybe the full financial relationship, and, you know, we were able to come in and show them that there was actually room to grow there. And so, you know, I don't think you can possibly know your customers, at least not at scale, right? Not at any kind of scale. You can't know them the way that the data will help you know them. We're mere humans, you know? And so we've got a lot of customer relationships that we're juggling, and, you know, we're focused, you know, often on a number of different things that are going on in our businesses. And so it's literally impossible, I think, to know every customer at this level of knowledge with respect to what's that customer's financial life look like. You know, we see a world wherein this information can be helpful, can augment. It's not just about how do we uncover information about our customers or uncover insights about our customers and then, you know, leverage just exclusively digital marketing in order to try to make the connection. We really look at this as, you know, what I like to say is empowering the relationship channel. You've got the personal relationships with your customers. This is just helping you understand them. You know, you're having a conversation with somebody and they forget to tell you the fact that they've got a loan somewhere else. You know, there's so much to know about these customers, and you have so many customers to spread your team and resources, you know, over, that I think what we're doing here is really helping you get efficient about understanding them in a deeper way. And then also get efficient about, all right, well, now that I do understand them, you know, here's my target list and here's kind of my prioritization and how I go after my customers to deepen the relationship, to have conversations with them. Because, you know, often it's what we're able to uncover in many cases, tip of the iceberg, right? You kind of only know what is going on maybe within your own ecosystem there as a financial institution. You can't see the extent of your customers' financial lives that are out there. So, you know, this is a way to help you identify and prioritize those customers that you can grow with. And then now you can go apply your team, your relationship managers, your loan officers to go out, you know, have personal conversations with them, deepen the relationship and understand more about what their financial lives look like. Because it's clear in most cases when we're doing this analysis that the banks don't know quite as much as they think they do about their own customer base, you know, and that's okay. Right. Again, we're just humans. We don't think like machines, but that's why we've built machines to be able to do this for us, so we can surface this stuff up and put it into your awareness. So that way you can do something about it.
Totally. And it is, it's the human powered aspect of this. The fact that I know the family deeply or know the kids or know how they're involved is one aspect of that relationship that is so valuable. But increasingly, I'm of the belief that the banks that are going to really continue to succeed are going to increasingly adopt this idea that they are in the customer financial success, financial progress or outcome business. And they're going to need this information to help them craft or advise on plans for their customers to help them be more successful. And that's what will ultimately deepen the relationships.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, the good news is that you've already got these customer relationships as a community bank, whether you've captured part of it or all of it or whatever the case is. And, you know, you are the incumbent here, right? And so it's your business to lose ultimately. And there's a lot of people asking your customers for their business every single day, right? You've got, you know, companies like Credit Karma that are sending out millions of offers probably every day to folks to offer them some kind of credit product or now deposit products and all types of other things. But the connection that exists on a relationship level is stronger than that, right? And so if you know who your banker is or your relationship manager is and you know the bank that's down the street, that's a stronger connection than that digital connection is. And so as our technology has been built and as we evolve it, we really see it as this nice blend between human aspect of banking and helping inform our people and empower our people to go out and build deeper relationships with customers, you know, versus those competitors that are out there that are exclusively digital. They can never have what community banks have in terms of the relationship power, you know, and so, you know, such an advantage, I think, to the community banks that are out there. And by, you know, leveraging a little bit of data to help them focus where it counts, I think, you know, really moves the needle for our customers.
Well, let's go into an example, Brian, of you go in, you help the bank organize and really understand what's actually happening in their data and where those opportunities are. Let's talk about a bank that has embraced this, done that work, and now is benefiting from it in both the business side and with their customers.
Yeah. You know, a lot of what we're doing here is focusing on sales enablement, right? So if you look at the results that what we're doing, I like to look at individual sales wins that end up happening. And I know sales can often be a bad word in banking, right? That, you know, we're very cautious, I think, in the banking industry about, you know, feeling like we sell too much, right? Or sell to our customers too much. But really, you know, from my viewpoint, I really look at sales as a service aspect, right?
We're all in sales. Let's be honest.
Yeah. We are all ultimately in sales. But if you're selling right, you're helping your customer with something, right? That's how I look at it when I'm out there and I'm trying to sell the Revio platform, really selling the benefits of what is the end result of Revio, right? And so I like to look at things in terms of sales wins. And so I was talking to a client of ours just a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, we're talking about results, and they're telling me about how some of their folks in their branches were using this data. And I just kind of got the story of a couple of wins that ended up coming from it. This particular manager that was tipped off to the fact that this customer might have had a more complex financial life than maybe he previously knew. And really what we've learned from this engagement in particular is that oftentimes these insights are just the tip of the iceberg, right? We can only see what we can see in terms of the transactional data that's happening within your four walls. But often that tips us off to a much deeper opportunity that maybe we couldn't even detect, right? And so that's what happened in this case. This particular manager reached out to the customer based on some HSA account transfers and started to do what we call informed discovery, right? You know some of the answers to the test already when you reach out. And you start having these conversations with the customer. But it turns out that this customer also has, in addition to these HSA transfers that they were engaging in, also has two other operational accounts at another bank. And so, you know, branch manager wins $2.5 million worth of deposits based upon the fact that we showed them an insight where a customer was using these external products at a high volume, and they dug a little bit deeper and understood a little bit more, but they knew where to apply their talent, right? They knew where to apply their effort to focus on a customer like this instead of just, you know, sitting there in a sea of customers that they might have. You know, if you've got 10,000 customers, where do you start? You know, where do you start? And so we can help you start on those 500 that can really move the needle, or that 1,000 that can really move the needle where you need to focus your time, efforts, and energy. You know, the end result there was $2 million in two demand deposit accounts, another $500,000 that went into a CD, right, off of this one call. You know, same manager also captured another $2 million in, it was either one or two other customer relationships that they ended up capturing off of it. But add that up, that's $4.5 million worth of new deposit at the bank. 4 million of those weren't even in interest bearing. Only $500,000 of that was an interest bearing account. And so that's a real win. I like to look at things in terms of where were the tactical kind of wins that happened, because if you add those up, that win in and of itself, you know, it's a massive win. Really doesn't even matter what bank it's at. Capturing $4.5 million worth of deposits is a huge win. But you add that up and, you know, maybe multiply that times a couple from using these insights to go out there and take targeted action against these customers and actually get to know them and understand where those opportunities are, you know, that really compounds and snowballs quite quickly. in your ability to go out there and compete and win business. So those are the types of results that we like to see. And those are the types of fun conversations we like to have with our customers when they're using the platform to actually go out and win business.
Great story. Take me through the process. Let's say I'm a bank president and I'm interested in, to your point a minute ago, we've got a whole bunch of customers. We need to better prioritize who we focus our attention on. Take me through that process of how do you come in? How do you help us have that prioritized call list, action list to really go after?
You know, once we form a partnership with a bank, we're taking their data and we ingest that data, you know, and risk of getting a little bit too technical here, but we, you know, we don't need a true kind of core integration or API integration to the core. We can take that stuff and batch and process it through our model. And, you know, the bank is then able to access that information through our platform. And what they're really seeing is a segmented lists based upon the product usage of those customers that then get prioritized in terms of the volume of that product usage. And by the way, this is product usage that's external to the bank, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're able to see what that customer is engaging in outside of the financial institution and then help prioritize that down. So an individual can either interact with that information within the platform itself. We have a web application that, you know, is a secure web application, mm-hmm. and we keep the data secure, so on and so forth. So you can either interact with that information through that web application, or we can pipe that directly into a CRM system if they're up on you know, one of the many commercially available CRM systems, and we can put that right into the hands of a relationship manager, right into the hands of a loan officer to then be able to go start taking follow-up action on that. And so that's really the first order effect, I think, of doing this analysis and gaining these insights. There's been this second kind of surprising order of effect that occurs as well, which is once you start understanding where your outflows are going, and what we're really building at the end of the day is a competitive picture for the bank that they've not really had before, mm-hmm. right? That we can really tell on a per provider level and on a per product level with that provider where your customers are doing business outside of your financial institution. And it really, I think, it forces the leaders at a bank to take a look at that and say, all right, well, here's where my competition is. And if I want to go capture these customer relationships, do I actually have the right product mix to do it, right? Mm. Am I competitive enough to capture this commercial credit card business? Or am I competitive enough to capture what are, you know, deposit outflows from my bank from a yield perspective on a higher interest type account? And so that's the interesting second order effect, is that really, I think, that look in the mirror, so mm-hmm. to speak, is looking at where those outflows are going, looking at where my customers are doing business externally, and asking myself the question, does my product mix stack up? Do I compete? And so that's the interesting kind of second order effect that's come from all this as well.
Hmm. Well, I know you've got a big vision for where this can go, and you sort of have described these first couple stages of it. What aspects of that can you share at this point as you think about where you're headed in the next year or two?
Yeah, we do have a long roadmap, right? I think where we focus the next 12 months, I think there's a lot to do on the insights and analysis that we're doing. I think we're scratching the surface there. We're delivering a lot of value already, but I think that there's more to deliver there in terms of how we can leverage first party data from the bank. So the bank's core data, both in terms of their transactional data, which is where we've derived a lot of our insights to date. So those are all associated with DDA accounts that they have and the inflows and outflows and the transactions that we can see through those accounts. And so I think there's a lot more value to squeeze out of that data set that we can help banks leverage on actionable opportunities. And I think that's, you know, another key differentiator here is where can I use these insights to take action? I think the next component for us and where we're focused right now and over the next 12 months is where are the other data sets that we can leverage inside the financial institution, right? Things like loan files. And so we're working through a great project right now, helping banks understand where they have single service kind of customers that are on the loan side, right? So maybe you've got a customer that has a loan and they've got a great operational account with you, and that's fantastic. You've kind of captured that customer, but you've also got customers that have an operational account, but they're just parking the loan payment there. I mean, you've got the DDA, but you don't really have that operational kind of relationship with them. And then you've got kind of a third bucket there of customers that are, you know, doing all of their deposit activity outside the bank. So I think there's a lot more to do there. that we're focused on over the next 12 months, we're really leaning into these aspects of helping banks understand where they stack up competitively with these customers and trying to build more of those types of insights into the platform. I think beyond that, like as you get beyond 2024 and kind of into 2025 and where this all can ultimately lead, I think it's all about how do we help banks leverage first-party data and maybe start getting into some second and third-party data to help them be competitive, not only at deepening relationships, but really also in net new customer acquisition too. So I think there's a lot more that we can do there, but you can't boil the ocean and you got to start where I think you're having the most impact and evolve from that point. But I think there's a lot we can do in the future as we build and continue to gain more insights into helping banks understand how to be competitive. I think there's a lot more we can do beyond what we're doing today. So I think there's more to do on the strategic level, you know, helping banks deliver other products and services to their customers that maybe they're not even offering today. But I won't get too far into those details, but, you know, hopefully we'll have surprises coming out in, you know, late 2024 and into 2025 that show banks, you know, how they can both leverage the data, but also leverage our platform in order to deliver other products and services to those customers.
Thank you for sharing that. So one of the things that I feel like we, as an industry around banking, you know, every bank knows they have this data, it's data, data, data. They talk a lot about it. There's been a lot of lacking infrastructure. You don't see that many banks having things like a data warehouse, data lake in a really unified manner. What do you think? You mentioned earlier, maybe some of it was just lack of interest and desire historically, but what do you think has held community banks back from being more, even what I'd call data literate and capable?
Yeah, that's a really good one. So I think one of the issues when it comes to things like data is it's a very nebulous topic, totally. Right? I mean, and there's all kinds of things you can do with your data. And some of them you can derive value from and others you don't, you know? And I think there's a lot of folks out there pushing various data initiatives. And there's a lot of opportunity, I think, because of the nebulousness of the topic of data, there is a tendency that we've seen to kind of misprescribe what the solution is, right? Oh, well, I want to use my data, so I have to go get a data warehouse, right? I like can't even do anything until I get a data warehouse. That's got to be number one. Well, you know, that's not true either, right? I mean, get a data warehouse for certain things that you need to go execute on. But, you know, where we've been able to kind of plug in there is, you know, really helping banks take that first step, right? And there are other banks that do have very robust data strategies that are also tapping into what we're doing, right? And leveraging what we're doing. But I think it's been very challenging for banks because they're receiving messages from all angles around how to leverage data, how best to leverage data, and what you can do with it. And then beyond that, it's the levels of the data and what you're trying to get out of it, right? That is it really pure benchmarking that I'm after? Is it general ledger performance that I'm after? Those kind of elements that I think are really kind of akin to looking in the rearview mirror. They're important. It's important to know, but how actionable is it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think banks have been challenged simply because of the number of messages that they're ultimately hitting from the market, right? Because there's a lot of people out there that are trying to sell a lot of solutions to a lot of things. And so most of those messages that banks are receiving, I think are, you know, coming from folks who are trying to sell them a solution for something, you know? And so that I think has led to some of the lack of adoption. Beyond that, there's been a lack of vendors in this industry. I think you've had a limited set of folks who've actually been out there, and it's probably because, you know, this is regulated data and it's, you know, it's a high kind of barrier to entry to get into this industry, to be able to work with this type of data, because it is, you know, a lot of it's sensitive PII that you're ultimately dealing with there and financial records and transactional histories, so on and so forth. So that's been a barrier, I think, that's prevented more vendors from getting into the industry or more technology partners from getting into the industry to be able to provide appropriate solutions for bankers. And so I think where we are in this decade for most banks is no longer optional. So if you don't have a data strategy, if you're not even thinking about it, then you're pretty far behind. If you are thinking about it, then it's time to start learning more. And that involves, I think, going out. You've got to talk to vendors and technology partners because they have a perspective, right? And a lot of them have been researching this and building on this and building strategies towards this for a long time. So you need to go out there and start figuring out, if you're a bank that doesn't know what you're going to do with your data, then technology partners are a great place to start, right? Because you can go have conversations with them. You know, when you're having a conversation with them, that they're implicitly trying to sell you something, but at least it's information that you're getting to help you start to paint a picture of what's out there for the bank. What can I do? What's possible? What's in the realm of possibility? And that's maybe the first place that you can go to start thinking about that. But it's certainly not the only thing you need to do as a banker. So it's a tough topic. I think what's important to us boils down to actionability of it, right? A lot of insights you can kind of derive from your data. How actionable is it? So, you know, my advice to any bankers that would be listening to the podcast is to really kind of hold that up as the test of any solution that you look at, is how actionable is this insight to me? Can I actually do something with this information that's going to help me grow?
I think that's a great set of advice. And, you know, it occurs to me, I think it's easy to get tempted into this idea that we need to go build this significant infrastructure and throw a whole bunch of money at it, and this magical data warehouse appears. And I think what I find far too often is it ends up not being you have the term data lake as a emerging topic in the world, but far too often they end up becoming data swamps, mm-hmm. where you just throw a bunch of information into something and you got to drain it. It's not useful. And so to me, that actionability, the having the set of questions you really have that you can act upon, or the desired set of answers that you want that you can act upon, seem like a great jumping off point to start to build some of that literacy, build some of that confidence, so that you can eventually do this for more and more information. You mentioned, you know, first party and third party data. Most businesses, not even banks, most businesses have not become very good at combining those, often because they don't have the right sets of questions. They just haven't even accumulated what would we even want to potentially understand if we could. And so some of it starts with that.
You touched on it right there, which is you kind of don't know what you don't know if you're, you know, not a data nerd or somebody who's really looking at this stuff in a very deep way. You don't know what you don't know yet if you're not really looking at data and have been looking at it for a long time, or at least long enough to start building a picture of how you can leverage it. And so that's it right there. You just got to start learning. And so there's a lot of places you can get that information, I think, as a banker.
Well, Brian, you've got an interesting perspective. I mentioned earlier, you spent some time inside of a fintech accelerator where you got to meet a whole bunch of startups that were trying to help and work with banks. How does that help you in your role now trying to build a startup for banks at Revio?
Yeah. Oh man, I can't even list the number of ways that has been beneficial to me. So the background here and really how I got into fintech is Little Rock, Arkansas, you know, post-military, had gotten out, was going to college, and was at the time was working on my MBA. And I learned about this startup accelerator program that was up and coming in Little Rock at this place called the Venture Center. And I checked it out, and they actually had a role that was open, and I applied for the role. And, you know, like many stories, right, you kind of sometimes apply for roles you may not be qualified for yet. And the only thing I was probably qualified for at the time was I just knew how to get stuff done, right? Like I wasn't going to let anything stop me. And maybe that's why I ultimately got hired, because of that military background and kind of that, you know, I'm just going to push through and get the mission done. And so that's what kind of got me into fintech, is that accelerator program. I learned so much. I mean, I met bankers from all over the country and met entrepreneurs who were solving unique problems in the industry. And I think that really gave me a vantage point that I've been able to leverage ever since, right? You know, we're faced as entrepreneurs with every day we make consequential decisions, you know, and you've got to be comfortable making those consequential decisions. And I think that exposure to that and watching others in that environment, and nobody knows what the day is going to bring you. You know, there's always something going on as an entrepreneur, always some problem you have to solve, and so on and so forth. But kind of watching others in that role and working with others in that role, it gave me a deep appreciation for entrepreneurship, for the industry, because we worked with one of the core providers. FIS was one of the sponsors of one of the accelerator programs. The Independent Community Bankers of America, the ICBA, sponsored the other one. So we got a great survey of the cross-section of banking in the country. And, you know, I loved both of those programs. I loved the folks that I met and the bankers that I met from all over the country that were a part of it. And really, I was just talking to one of my MBA professors the other day. Actually, I ended up dropping out of the MBA program because I was getting more at the place that paid me, you know, at my day job. And it was actually a day and night job, because I swear that job was 14 hours a day for years, right? And we were talking about that. I just had coffee with him this week, as a matter of fact. And we kind of joked about the fact that I took his class and I ended up at Venture Center, and then I ended up dropping out of the MBA program. But it was the best decision I made, because I really was learning so much at that. And I really look at it like a very unique education that you really can't even pay for, working in an environment like that. And so, you know, super, super grateful to all the folks that I met and the mentors that I gained along the way. So, you know, look, I learned that it's hard. I learned that it's a lot of hard work, and that it's that perseverance that's going to largely determine whether or not you're successful or not successful. And so, you know, that's one of the takeaways for me.
That's great. Well, you also got exposed, as you mentioned, to a lot of banks through that. And now you're in a spot where you're working with banks on a day-to-day basis. What do you find distinguishes a bank that you say, okay, they're going to be okay, they're making progress toward the future, versus one that you think, oh, they could be in trouble?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And my answer for that is their ability to reach a decision. Right? I think you can tell a lot about a bank if they get caught into analysis paralysis. And, you know, look, in this industry, we're dealing with risks, right? Mm-hmm. And bankers have to deal with risks all day long, right? I mean, they're really in the business of managing financial risk, right? And so you have to be very cautious in your decisions as a bank that you make. But I think sometimes that can bleed over into a zero risk mentality where, you know, everything we do as an institution, there can be no risk of failure for it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that creates decision gridlock that ultimately results in the bank going nowhere. And I think that that's maybe one of the biggest challenges, and it's on a cultural level with institutions, is to how can we evaluate solutions, technologies that we, because as a bank, you have to leverage technology today, right? And if you're not leveraging technology to a great degree, that bank is not going to exist in 10 years from now, right? And so I think your ability to actually process information and reach a decision and move forward is going to, it's one of the things that could hold a lot of banks back. And, you know, for me, it's an indicator that this is not a bank that's ready for what we're bringing, right? Mm-hmm. But they're also not ready for a lot of other stuff too. And that's going to affect them over the long term. So I think that's underestimated, the ability of the culture of the bank being such to where you can evaluate things and make a decision and move forward and do so in a timely manner. Because if it takes you 18 months to make a decision, compound that times all the decisions you have to make, and you're going to be a decade behind everybody else. And so I think that's where a lot of banks that we talk to can work to improve themselves organizationally.
Well, that's super helpful insight, Brian. In the few minutes we've got left, few kind of rapid fire questions I'd love to get from you yourself. You know, one of the things I find in successful people is they often have kind of habits or rituals that they really adhere to. Any of those that you have and that you find you get a lot out of?
Yeah, I do have a couple there. One of them is very simple, and it's a notebook. I ritually use a notebook. I always have a notebook on me. This is where I write ideas. This is where I, you know, keep task lists and those type of things. And so I think for me, I've tried many different types of ways to kind of keep track of the various things that you have to do as an entrepreneur. I have still never found one that is better than a great notebook that you can throw in your bag or carry around with you. That way you can keep track of the things that you've got to get done. The second one that I use very religiously is this concept called time blocking. And it's, you know, it augments my use of this notebook here, and that it helps allocate my time appropriately. One of the biggest challenges, I think, as an entrepreneur is time allocation, right? How do I allocate my time towards the product? Because there's many things I could be doing with my time. Some of those things create value, some of those things do not. And so being very deliberate about time blocking myself in projects allocating that time on my calendar to accomplish large tasks or to accomplish, you know, large portions of a project, I think has helped me make or break many times over. Right. And so I didn't know that when I started my whole journey, right, of entrepreneurship and living this fast paced life. Consequently, in my early days there, I dropped a lot of balls that I needed to keep in the air. But that's kind of a discipline that I've developed around my time management and around, you know, task management for myself. And so, and if you can't do it for yourself, it's hard to help other people do it. And so as you're building a team, right, I think it's important that you're doing that and demonstrating kind of how to get it done and demonstrating a high degree of performance and productivity. So that way your team sees what good looks like and can kind of follow you in that journey.
So. Great. Well, thank you for sharing that. What lessons do you feel like you have learned so far in your entrepreneurial journey as you're now into your next startup?
Well, firstly, the lessons all come from mistakes. And the idea that entrepreneurship and this journey is, you know, everyone looks in from the outside and they see the press releases and they're like, oh, man, look at all those great milestones. But what you don't see is everything that happened between those press releases.
Sure.
You know, so, you know, it's always, you know, the way the sausage is made is always, you know, a little, you know, dirtier than people like, you know, you're the outside looking in. I think the number one thing that I've learned along the journey is the importance of culture and the team. I had a deep appreciation for this when I came from my military days because we had that, right? We had probably one of the highest performing cultures in the squadron that I was in compared to every other squadron that existed out there. We were the most decorated naval aviation unit since Vietnam, right? I mean, these people that we were working with, it was what we call op tempo. It was a high tempo all the time. You know, excellence was the standard. And, you know, so I had this really great example, but I was a part of an institution that was way older than me, right? That had been built over many decades. Sure. So the challenge, I think, for entrepreneurs is I knew what good looked like, but it was how do I replicate that? How do I recreate that from the ground up? And I think that I went through the early days and the trials and tribulations that every entrepreneur goes through, but I kind of knew where I wanted to end up, at least, was something that looked like that. And the importance of the team that you build and the culture that you create with that team, you know, what a privilege we have as entrepreneurs and as leaders to be able to build something like organizational culture, to be able to build a place that not only does good things for your customers, but is also a great, fun place to show up to and work at every day. And you're working with people that you like. And, you know, I found that high performance is contagious, right? If you show up at a place and it's low performance, guess what? You're going to be low performance too. Sure. Now, if you show up at a place and the standards are high and you're learning and you're able to grow as an individual and learn new professional skills in advance and the standards high, there's a certain type of person that wants to be at a place like that. And you've got to find those types of people and put them in that environment. And so, you know, the importance of culture, the importance of team, but what a privilege it is to be able to grow that, right? I think from my first venture, which was successful, certainly learned a lot of those lessons and trying to implement them here at Revio as we're growing.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Last question, Brian, what are you most excited about in the coming year as you think about life, Revio, et cetera?
Exciting year. I think things economically are on the upswing, just, you know, in the macro environment. Hopefully, fingers crossed, I'm right on that. Those predictions are always hard, but that's kind of how I feel here in Q4 of 23. You know, we just raised capital in Q3, as you know, and we're in the process of deploying that capital right now on growth. So all the things that I just talked about from a cultural perspective and the privilege we have to be able to grow a team, I get to go execute on that in 2024. So for me, that's the pinnacle is being able to do that and deliberately build the culture of our organization. So we're a small team today and, you know, we'll continue to grow that through 2024. And yeah, I'm just excited about where we're going. I feel the momentum despite the holidays here and a lot of, you know, folks throttle back to 50% through the holidays. I feel the momentum kind of going into the new year. So I'm excited about it.
Very great and very cool. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining. I'm so excited for you as well. I think you're solving a real, present, practical problem set that banks really need. And that's the hallmark of a great place to start in working in an industry like this. So we need more entrepreneurial leaders in this industry solving real problems like you are and providing practical solutions. So I'm excited that we're on the journey with you at BankTech Ventures. And look forward to seeing increased positive impact in the banks that you work with like you are today. So thanks again, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. And I appreciate you having me on the podcast. And I certainly appreciate all the support that you've provided, both in terms of Bank Tech Ventures, but also you personally. Super impactful. I have always enjoyed our conversations, and it was fun to do one in this format. So thanks.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Operate Podcast. If you like this conversation, as a favor to me, you can rate us, review us, or subscribe, or tell your friends. You can also reach out to us on Twitter @Operate Podcast. Until next week, get out there and operate.